From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The reality of war is closing in on us now. We can almost taste it. The troops are massed. The television cameras are pointed. Baghdad embassies are cleared to bare bones. A Made in America deadline looms. But as millions brace for what can surely appear inevitable, others in America and abroad are still frantically searching, even now, for the 11th hour Hail Mary idea to sidestep war, to find another solution to the standoff over Iraq. It's not begun until it's begun. But what would it take now to stop it? The Pope as a human shield? A preemptive declaration of victory? The mother of all diplomatic coups? We're opening the microphones for a brainstorm tonight. Diplomatic, strategic, spiritual, even military, you name it. Is there an exit ramp on the Iraq warpath, inside the box or out? Not an empty gesture, but a real alternative. Give us your best shot. However unexpected, are you resigned to war? Eager to get it over with, or are you still thinking of peace? Prove it. Join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by James Carroll, a columnist for the Boston Globe and author of Toward a New Catholic Church, The Promise of Reform and Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews. Good evening and welcome, James Carroll.
Greetings, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. And with us in the studio, Dr. Jeswald Salacuse, Henry J. Baker Professor of Law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and author of The Global Negotiator, Making, Managing, and Mending Deals Around the World in the 21st Century. That's a mouthful, but it sounds right on target. Thanks for joining us, Jed Salacuse.
Thank you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight, we're joined by our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
So, yes, hello to you, Jack. Here we are. It can seem as though it is all but a done deal. There are still significant sounds in the U.N., and I should say that the Monday so-called ultimatum date or deadline date of the United States, effectively, March 17th, appears to have developed a little wiggle room today. We don't know, though we heard Ari Fleischer say no, no, no to 45 days. But the sense that war is imminent and maybe inevitable looms, James Carroll, you've written just today in the Boston Globe that one must never say it's inevitable until the bullets fly, and maybe not even then. But the way out of this thing at this point is not exactly clear. So we wanted to sit down tonight and say, all right, if anybody's got a great idea, that Hail Mary idea that they realistically think, not just in a pure pipe dream, but that might have a chance of getting this done, let's hear it. Is it too late for that, James Carroll, despite what you've written published only this morning?
Well, Tom, look at what's happening. The deadline isn't a deadline.
Got soft this afternoon.
The basic condition of the politics today is that the deadline, and what an aptly full of implication word that is, deadline, is not a deadline. It's still moving. And as long as the deadline is moving, the war is not inevitable. That's what I would say. As long as the White House is again and again and again retreating from its ultimata, which has been happening now for 3 weeks, then there is every reason to believe that world pressure, political pressure, pressure within the U.N., pressure from allies, now perhaps pressure from Great Britain, is having its effect.
Despite all the troops, and we've been talking with them in Kuwait today in preparation for a story tomorrow, and
well, obviously,
those Apache helicopters are coming out of their wrappers.
That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is not despite all of that, it's because of it. And if we could flip a little bit here and let people start claiming the causality, the buildup has led to a tremendous political pressure on Saddam Hussein, then we have a different context within which to have this discussion.
A flip, a little judo, a little aikido. Jez Salacuse, is it possible? You look at the dynamics of conflict all the time. Look at this one. Grand scale. Doesn't get much grander. Do you see running room here? Do you see open blue sky where a peace plane could fly?
Well, I don't see a broad blue sky, but I do see some opportunity. I think that one of the things that made this a crisis was, I think, that accentuated the crisis was the March 17th deadline. And one of the ways you begin to deflate a crisis is to deal with the time constraint. And I think that's what's happening. We're in a dynamic now where that's being pushed back. The other factor is that I think what convinced George Bush to move ahead is he thought he had a coalition of the willing. Mm-hmm. That coalition is now crumbling, and there's really, it may end up, there's not a coalition, there's just the United States. And that, I think, changes the dynamic of this conflict a great deal.
And yet, you know this president, at least in the way that we all do. He is a guy who likes to stick to his word. He said at the press conference in front of all of us last week, we will have a vote next week. That's this week. They're still saying they're going to be pushing for that vote, even if they're going to lose it. And he said clearly, the United States does not need permission. We will defend the United States of America. Does this sound like a leader, like a chief executive who's prepared to dicker?
Yeah, well, on the one hand, there's that. But on the other hand, there is the continued insistence on trying to get a resolution through the UN. Now, what does that signify? It must signify that the UN, in his mind, is important, that having UN cover, if you will, is going to give some protection, give some credibility, give some legitimacy to this act. Now, if he doesn't get that, does he have to go back and recalculate his strategy?
And yet, Jack Beatty, you know this is a president who said he'll go naked. He'll go without that UN endorsement if necessary. Jack, help us get right down to it here. Help us to imagine. I mean, maybe it will happen right there on the floor of the Security Council, which the whole world has become more familiar with in the last couple of months than any time in my memory. But let's say, well, maybe it'll happen there. Maybe it'll happen elsewhere, Jack. How could this war be defused even now? Give us a couple of Hail Marys.
Well, one would be the Gilgamesh option. I'm afraid I'm hearing repeats on this, but I'll keep going. And that refers to the ancient Babylonian king. Recently, Saddam Hussein, talking to his military commanders, invoked the legend of Gilgamesh, the king who left his people, left the government in charge of the Senate, and went into exile, and only to come back years later. Now, was it significant that he mentioned Gilgamesh, the king who went into exile? Who knows? But secondly, there's another way Saddam could affect this. Suppose he completely cooperates with the inspectors and the proactive, you know, unconditional, complete accounting that they want. Suppose he gives that to them. And the inspectors say, by God, we've found everything. We've accounted for all the discrepancies in our where we left off in 1998. And we're ready to pronounce Iraq now within the terms of the UN mandate. And then George Bush could, at that point, it seems to me, to get back to Jim's scenario, claim victory. The guy is disarmed, according to the inspectors. So that's two ways I think Saddam mm-hmm. could affect it. Also, I think publicity could affect it. You know, on the one hand, there are hints that we know where there are weapons of mass destruction, and we're not telling the inspectors. Donald Rumsfeld has hinted at this. Well, suppose somebody in the Pentagon or the CIA leaks that in effect we have been subverting the inspections and that we're about to make a war when we don't have to. Or suppose this, the other aspect of publicity, we know he doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. How do we know that? Well, we know that because General Hussein Kamal, the source whom the cousin of Saddam Hussein, who was murdered when he went back, the defector whom President Bush cites all the time as the source for Saddam was working on nukes, he gave an interview when he came into Jordan. He gave an interview to the weapons inspectors then in 1995, and he told them, and I quote from it, "I ordered destruction of all chemical weapons. All weapons, biological, chemical, missiles, nuclear, were destroyed. I made the decision to disclose everything so Iraq could return to normal." And it goes on. This has only appeared thus far in a hint in Newsweek that the full transcript of this interview is now on the web. This says that the source the administration has been citing to establish the idea that he has weapons of mass destruction says that he destroyed them.
So there's the Pentagon Papers scenario.
Yes, indeed. The scandal here that could come out if some enterprising newspaper person wants to get on it and essentially confront the administration with what could be a very cynical design indeed.
And yet, James Carroll, you have written that war itself has a kind of gravity that sucks people and whole nation into its orbit. Are we past the point of resistance right now? New polls out today, New York Times, saying public opinion shifting towards support for war, even without UN support, would rather have more time, would by a slim margin, 52% to 44%, would rather give inspections more time, but if it has to happen, 55% to 41% now saying without UN sanction, yes, we may have to do this.
Well, the first point, your second one, the polls, I don't think are particularly significant. Polls change quickly in relationship to events. Lyndon Johnson depended on polls to make crucial decisions to continue escalation in the fall of 1967. And by the spring of 1968, he had renounced his own political ambitions because events completely changed the way in which the public perceptions of that war unfolded.
And by any large measure, this is still a very divided public in its opinions,
yes,
even
and,
by the polls.
And you could get a very different set of polls a week after this war begins.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first point. The second point, though, is about the temptation to go to war. I do believe we should be aware of it. We should understand that what war offers us at this point is a way out of this ambiguity.
The temptation? We always say war is hell. Of course war is hell. Of course war is hell. And you're saying despite that, it's attractive?
Well, war is hell, but there's a long human tradition of the celebration of valor in combat, the celebration of bloodshed for high values, the high rhetoric of war. And we need to just acknowledge that I believe that that's actually the single largest psychological force that is at play here. And the reason I say that is because there are no other set of rational explanations for what's going on now. That's what I would say. War offers this government and perhaps this nation a way out of a terribly ambivalent, ambiguous, alienated, and somewhat frightening present situation.
Jez Zelikius, how about that? A way out of ambiguity?
Not only that, but I think that we've kind of sanitized war. When we had the experience of the Gulf War in 91, which had relatively few casualties, was done very quickly, and I think we're hoping to have a replay of that. What's interesting about the letter that came out today from the military people is they were pointing that the 91 war was not as costless as we thought.
This is a letter signed by some 900 military.
Yeah, a figure I didn't realize, 164,000 American veterans of that war are considered disabled. Almost 50,000 children in Iraq died before they should have. So I think we need a debate in this country about the costs of this thing, and I fear that our politicians really haven't done us a good deed in the sense that they haven't really asked for a real accounting of what is this thing going to cost, not only in money, but in human suffering and in retarded development of our own economy as well as the impact on the Middle East.
But, Jez, we're counting on you to be the hard-nosed one here tonight. Mm-hmm. Is this all just pie in the sky? The troops are there. You've heard what George Bush has said. Is this a done deal? People have said it's a done deal for 6 months now, more than 6 months now. Maybe this speaks to Jim Carroll's point. They said it was a done deal and still hasn't happened. And yet, is it naive even to think at this point that this could be somehow put off or not even happen?
Well, if you talk about probabilities, I think the probabilities are that it's going to happen. But it is not 100% probability. And so long as you have even that little window, I think you have to work with what you have. And I think you're beginning to see various cracks in the coalition, which I think is very significant. Other factors are now beginning to come up and come out to the public. And I think maybe people are beginning to reflect on the genuine costs and risks that we run with this war.
Jack, are you still thinking up there in New Hampshire? Are we going to fly in the Pope and have him sit on a throne next to Saddam? Are we going to have Jimmy Carter walk across the desert toward Baghdad?
But, you know, I think three people could play a decisive role here. After all, the key actor, one of them, is George Bush. Bush Sr. Bush Sr. wrote in his memoirs that assigning young soldiers to a fruitless hunt for an entrenched dictator and condemning them to fight in an unwillable urban guerrilla war would plunge that part of the world into greater instability. He was writing that about the first Gulf War. I have a suspicion he feels the same way about this one. Second, Karl Rove. You know, last week we arrested this number two man or number three man in al-Qaeda, and Iraq stepped on that, this great success in the war on terror, and it barely registered with all the noise on Iraq. So I can imagine Rove telling the president, listen, let's not spoil our storyline here. We're doing better than we think. And finally, Billy Graham, who seems to have access to Bush's conscience.
The ideas are popping here tonight. We're asking you to join us. We're talking about Hail Mary passes for peace, last-ditch alternatives to all-out war with Iraq. Are there any? Get creative. Get real. What's your idea? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about Hail Mary passes for peace, about last-ditch alternatives to all-out war with Iraq. Are there any? Get creative, get real. What's your idea? Do you believe that war is inevitable? Are there steps that might be taken even now to head it off? What's your best idea now for sidestepping war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by James Carroll, columnist for the Boston Globe and author of Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews, by Jeswald Salicuse, Henry J. Baker, professor of law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and author of many books, including The Global Negotiator, and by our own Jack Beatty. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Paul's calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, I thank you for letting me on the air.
Sure.
I think the answer really depends on the real desire of the Bush administration, whether it is to disarm Saddam Hussein and eliminate threat to the United States and to the world, or his design is really to a regime change and to change the balance of power in the Middle East, which a lot of people are saying the second thing is really what is going on.
We don't know about ultimately the balance of power, whether that could work, but don't you pretty well assume at this point, no matter what said Paul, that regime change is the bottom line?
No. I think if what President Bush is saying is that he's going to direct a war and bomb Iraq because it's a threat to the United States. Now, if the true reason for the war is to disarm Saddam Hussein, then the answer is, quite simple, and the idea has already been is circulating in the United Nations right now, and it's to give Saddam a very definitive checklist, and that if combined with the deadline, that if Saddam can achieve everything on the checklist by the deadline, then war should be averted. And I don't see the problem with that.
This is kind of the Canadian compromise, and it has been talked about a lot, but you're right, it goes to this essential question. And President Bush has said a lot of things. He said defending the United States is the goal. He said disarmament is the goal. But he has also said this guy's got to go. James Carroll, can you imagine this administration settling for anything less than the exit, one way or another, of Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think that the reason the United States embarked on this course in the first place was broader than Saddam Hussein. I think that Saddam Hussein represented the occasion for a display of the significance of overwhelming U.S. power, power that could not be resisted. That was what Iraq, unlike al-Qaeda, meant to us.
But if that's the friend, doesn't he have to go?
Well, let me just say, the irony here is that what has come about is a display of American overwhelming power that can be resisted, not only by Saddam Hussein, but by Pakistan, which announced today it's going to abstain, by Cameroon, the foreign minister canceled his appointment in the White House tomorrow. Cameroon and Pakistan are saying no to the imperial power. What does this tell us? Unbelievably, regime change in Iraq has suddenly taken second place to larger forces here.
James Carroll, Jeswald Salicuse, stand by. I want to turn to Spain right now, Alfaz, Spain, where Johan Galtung is joining us. Good evening and welcome, Johan Galtung.
Yeah, you say good evening, good morning, Mr. Word, my friend.
Yes, you're past midnight there.
Delighted. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for joining us. You are director of Transcend. It's a peace and development organization for conflict transformation. That sounds like alchemy. What's your view at this, what has seemed like this late hour, Johan Galtung? Can this war be put off? How would you imagine it might be done?
Well, what we people do, you see, is conflict mediation. I think we did a good job between Ecuador and Peru. We are working in Sri Lanka and things of that kind.
Mm-hmm.
But what we are used to is, of course, that the people, the parties engaged in the conflict, are listening and are, let us say, engaged in a dialogue. I'm afraid that's not the case at the White House. talking from Europe, we see the White House as totally autistic, locked into its own world, thinking its own thoughts, dreaming its own dreams. And that doesn't make it very good. But, of course, there are still things that can be done. And I think point one, to show more alternatives. And point two, to show the White House that, for instance, economic boycott of American products from the moment the bombs start falling will be a consequence that they are not going to like. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to the alternative, mm-hmm. I personally would think that the Helsinki-style conference like we had in 1973-75 that was as effective as anything in bringing an end to the Cold War, a conference for security and cooperation in the Middle East, which would take years, let us say 3 years, but it takes only 3 minutes to announce it. And that's what Germany and France should do. Their idea so far is what you could call inspection with a long time horizon and in depth. I like it, but it's not good enough. It's not constructive, not positive enough.
So you're talking economic boycott. You're talking economic boycott from Spain of the United States. Do you think that's an idea that might break through the shell of the White House that you describe?
Not from Spain, from the whole world. A world that brought 15 million people in the streets on the 15th of February is more than capable of doing that. That means not buying a single American product, not using the dollar as a currency, rewriting contracts, selling U.S. bonds, selling U.S. stocks, and so on. That is not something that the White House would appreciate very much.
Johann Galtung, if the White House is, to use your word, autistic, living in its own world, when you talk about a global economic boycott, I think maybe more than the White House it would find that hard to imagine. Is that realistic, or is that a kind of pipe dream?
I think you'll see it happen. I hear it all over the world. I'm traveling an awful lot. And I hear people, just ordinary people, saying exactly that. We'll see what happens. You won't see it in the corporate press around the world. You won't see it propagated there. You can see a lot of it flying around in the Internet.
You're also a champion.
Very easily, it's something everybody can do, you see. Mm-hmm. And it worked extremely well with South Africa.
It does not sound like it would be too attractive to American business. You're a champion of the Internet as an avenue for cultivating ideas like that. Is that happening? Is that network putting out that word?
You'll find the word flying around. And you'll find it whispered from mouth to mouth, and you'll find people taking theirs, looking for the alternatives. You know, how about Linux, the Finnish alternative to Microsoft, for instance? How about Coca-Cola instead of Coca-Cola? Lots of alternatives to McDonald's. You don't need to use dollars when you write a contract, or you're traveling and you pick up your currency. You could use euro or yen.
And suddenly there's a whole alternative world. Jez Salekeus, I see you, your head going this way and that about this list of ideas.
I really don't think a global boycott is really realistic, given the nature of globalization. Now, you mentioned South Africa. South Africa is certainly an example, but I think you have a very different situation. One of the things that made South Africa work was that governments participated and enacted legislation to impose sanctions. While you may have individuals in the street wanting to boycott the U.S. goods, I don't think governments are prepared, European governments are prepared, even if we go it alone, to enact a boycott of U.S. goods, I think, because it's also self-inflicting a wound on themselves.
Johann Galtung, is this only going to happen at the level of consumers, or can you imagine entire governments picking up a boycott idea?
You see, the level of consumers is much more important. I happen to know the leadership to some extent of South Africa. And both the leadership and Frederick de Klerk, the outgoing president, said that it was the moral impact of the common man and woman around the world that didn't buy South African apples that really was hitting them. Well, and I agree with the objection. I don't think the governments would do it. I'm thinking of something more important than governments. I'm thinking of people.
The problem is, of course, is that this would be ex post the attack, and it doesn't really deal with our problem, the problem that we're talking about, which is how do you stop war?
Though it could, if the White House took it seriously, could give the White House pause. But what's your estimate, Johann Galtung? Is this revenge or a price to be paid after a war, or do you imagine even now that this idea might penetrate and dissuade Washington?
Could imagine. And, of course, the pressure mechanisms would be via American corporations. Take into consideration that corporations have an average profit of 6%. That means that a decline in sales of 6% would be, let us say, quite interesting from that point of view. But I agree completely, this is not a positive, constructive idea. So for that reason, the other thing I said, and that's something governments would have to do, call a Helsinki-style conference around security and cooperation in the Middle East. Putting Israel, Palestine, the Kurds, and Iraq on the agenda have a lot of ideas. Let them sit and talk together and do exactly what happened in Helsinki in those 2 years.
Johan Galtung, you've given us a lot to think about. You've given us a great deal to think about, and we thank you for staying up to this very late hour in Spain to join us. Thank you so much for coming on tonight.
You are so welcome, and I would say God bless America, and by that I mean don't do this kind of thing.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks for being with us. I saw you furiously taking notes there, James Carroll.
Well, I think that your guest is describing the fact of our present moment, not a few, what has transpired over the last few weeks. Even while the press has been full of the rhetoric of the beginning of a new American empire, we've seen the end of the American empire. That's what this really, this moment amounts to. The fact that the United States of America cannot muster through its, the largest effort of its diplomatic corps in a generation, cannot muster one reliable ally, perhaps not even including Great Britain at this moment. It's a diplomatic disaster unparalleled. Even the moment when Woodrow Wilson got sick and was unable to follow through on the League of Nations doesn't compare to this. And what this suggests is that your guest is talking about an economic consequence of this. The world has, within a very brief time, lost faith in the United States of America. This is a shocking moment. And the revelation of it is the best hope for avoiding war.
It is a precarious moment, but we don't see the punctuation at the end of that precariousness yet, the thing that would actually stop this war. Paul's calling. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. This is a wonderful idea to explore this issue. I wanted to answer your direct question about two ideas about how war could be averted. Mm. But I'd first like to respond to the point that was just made about the end of what you might call Pax Americana. And I agree with the person who spoke. This is perhaps
James Carroll.
The saddest outcome of this entire conflict. It may be the end of American leadership and American moral authority. At a time when perhaps we could have acted to increase our moral authority in the world and increase our stature as a beacon of hope, we seem to be squandering it, and that's unfortunate indeed.
It is.
I do think that within the autistic White House, as it was described by your other speaker, there is a view that the outcome of this will be the opposite, that a successful war, once prosecuted, will lead to the same kind of sensation of well-being that accompanied the end of our first engagement there.
It's a strong and very persistent message and view from the White House.
It is, and I think they believe it. And it's unknown, of course. None of us know what that outcome will look like. But at this moment, it looks like we've squandered a great deal of moral authority, and that's a sad statement.
So, Paul, is there an out? Do you have an idea for
it? Yes, I have two to offer.
All right.
Unfortunately, well, I'll just say this about the two ideas. First, I think that there is a possibility that Saddam Hussein will elect to leave. And I think that could avert war. And there is a possibility that there could be a spectacular show of compliance, particularly with some of the major outstanding items, surrendering the remaining VX stocks and anthrax stocks to the United Nations, and a spectacular confession and admission might do it, shipping the 3,000-some scientists that Hans Blix would like to interview en masse outside of Iraq to a neutral third country where they would be free with their families to remain if they wished, and where they could be interviewed. That could do it. So those are two ideas. And then the final thing I'd like to say is I don't think there is anything that can be done on this side to avert the conflict. I believe that it is 100% inevitable unless there is some dramatic show of capitulation on the other side.
So you put it all in Saddam's hands at this late hour. Paul, thanks for all of that. And we hear there, in a way, an echo of the Gilgamesh option and also this, to use Paul's phrase, this spectacular compliance. How about it, Jez Salekeus? Can you imagine a compliance so spectacular that George W. Bush would say, "Ooh, we got our man"?
Well, if Saddam Hussein resigned or went off, resigned or left Iraq in some way, and this idea was suggested at a conference of Arab states by the head of the United Arab Emirates. But for example, if all the Arab states, you want a wild idea, if all the Arab states got together, the Arab League, and unanimously asked him to leave and send a delegation to Iraq to say this is the will or the view of the Arab people that you leave, that might be something, again, that influence him to leave. But
the last time there was that sort of crypt at the edge of the table, somebody was monkey's mustache, dissolved into nothing.
That's right. But they are now faced with a very serious consequences for the entire region. And they may in other words, they are really up against it, and that might galvanize them to take a unanimous stand. I mean, you're looking for wild Hail Mary ideas, and that's one.
Jack Beatty, we hear Paul with a terrific analysis there, but in his view, coming down to the conclusion that, yes, there are options, but Saddam holds them, no one else.
I think that's right, although but in the end, of course, it will be the president's decision. Every time he says this is up to Saddam Hussein, he's really passing the buck of responsibility. It'll be his decision to launch the troops. So I think in the end, you've got to get back to him. And, you know, thinking about that, his main worry is to face the electorate with Saddam in power. But what if Saddam is in power and is disarmed? Then he doesn't have to. Then facing the electorate is a different matter. Now, suppose the Democratic candidates and the Democratic leadership all decided en masse to say to him, "Mr. President, you have succeeded. These inspectors are doing their work. We are making progress. This is the finest example of coercive diplomacy we have ever seen."
Hail to the chief.
In other words, if they neutralized politically the thought of leaving Saddam in power, so that there was no political risk, because they're all over him saying you've saved us from war with this terrific, maybe that would do it.
Who's going to tell it to the president, Jack? You rattled off a list earlier: Billy Graham, the president's father, Karl Rove. Can you really imagine them whispering this, something like it, in his ear now?
I don't know. I think Rove, I mean, politics drove this this deployment, right? I mean, this was his effort to get the fall elections. That's why it was done then. Well, now it's taken on a kind of extra political, almost moral, theological cast. What if Karl Rove were to call it back to its original axis and say, you know, George, if we keep Saddam in power for a while, we can have him to run again in 2004.
Hit that straw man. We like
yes.
it. It worked before. We're talking
That's
tonight
right.
about Hail Mary passes for peace, last-ditch alternatives to all-out war with Iraq. Are we too narrowly focused? Are we in the thrall of war? Are there alternatives outside the box? What's your suggestion? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about Hail Mary passes for peace, about last-ditch alternatives to all-out war with Iraq. Are there any? What's your idea? Can any alternative work if the president is determined to have war? And what might be done, even now, to change George Bush's mind? Or is it time to fold the peace tent and get on with the war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined in the studio tonight by James Carroll, author of Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews, and Jeswald Salekeus from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, author of The Global Negotiator. We are joined now from Reston, Virginia, by Charles Sheehan Miles. He's a former Gulf War combat veteran. He's executive director of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute and a national representative for Veterans for Common Sense. Good evening and welcome, Charles Sheehan Miles.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for being with us. Now, you've delivered a letter today with a lot of military signatures on it. What's it about, and is this a showstopper?
Well, I don't think it's a shortstopper, a showstopper, but I'll give you a quick rundown of what we did. Last week, a number of us who were veterans who were concerned about this issue, we circulated a letter amongst people we knew, and in particular, we were looking for some senior retired military folks.
And what's the thrust of the letter, Charles?
Well, the main concern expressed in the letter is twofold. First, the risks associated with the war, both to our own troops and also the very severe risks to the civilian population who are likely to be the ones who are going to suffer the most mm-hmm. from what happens. And the flip side of that is the question of whether or not this will really actually enhance American security, and our signers don't believe that it will. Mm-hmm. And that was the basic thrust of the letter is.
And what kind of response?
It's a bad idea mm-hmm. and that the consequences will be far more severe than anything we're trying to prevent.
And you got 986 signatures or something. Do you consider this a good outcome or a poor outcome?
Well, I'll tell you, last Friday we had 30 signatures of senior officers. And I'm talking about people like Vice Admiral Jack Shanahan and Vice Admiral Ralph Weymouth, some pretty senior-level people.
All retired or any active duty?
These were all retired. Mm-hmm. We specifically haven't gone after active duty mm-hmm. people because it's really not it's probably not really in their purview to
yeah.
be writing letters.
Well, not in their interest at the moment, I assume.
But anyway, on Friday night, we sent out an email to the folks we knew and said, okay, we've got these 30 senior retired officers who signed this letter. We'd like you to sign on, too. And by Sunday, we had 950 some more signatures.
So what does this say to you, Charles Sheehan Miles, that they agree precisely with the issues that you've laid out, or that there's even a more general resistance than that? And do you imagine that there's an audience for this in the Pentagon, just to cite one building in Washington?
Well, you know, it's tough to say. Our audience is less the Pentagon than the president himself. And I think a lot of us believe that the president and his advisors, the people who are directly around him, like Karl Rove and Richard Powell and those folks, they're basically immune to any arguments that come from, for instance, the Democrats or the progressive community. However, if they hear from their own base constituency, retired generals, if they hear from major Republican donors saying that this is a bad idea, then maybe someone in the White House will sit up and listen.
Of course, we see Republicans in the polls out today, and with all the provisions about polls, but Republicans 70% thinking that it's worth the war would be worth the price, as opposed to 23% of Democrats. So, I'm sorry, 35% of Democrats approving that. So. I don't know what kind of numbers you've got in those conservative precincts.
It's hard to say. And I will raise the point when you say, you know, worth the price. The question is worth what price? You know, if we lay it out, as the White House has laid it out, that it's going to be a largely casualty-free war, that it's going to be easy, that it's going to be over in a few weeks, well, yeah, people may think it's worth the price.
Charles Sheehan Miles, you've also been close to the court case that has attempted to bring the courts into this to stop the march to war. Has that gone anywhere?
Well, it's been recently revived by the Federal Appeals Court in Boston. The case was filed by some active duty soldiers and some parents of active duty soldiers, and also by several congressmen. And basically, their argument was that. The Constitution of the United States grants the authority to declare war to Congress. Congress has not done so, and therefore it would be illegal for the president to launch a full-scale war without that declaration. Now, the initial court shot it down, denying that it was any jurisdiction. That's been revived by the appeals court, and they're going to be hearing that again.
So there's still a chance
basis.
In the courts. Mm.
But I'll be honest with you, I suspect the shooting's going to start before the courts get anywhere with it.
Mm-hmm.
There are some other things that are happening out there. You know, this issue with the retired generals and folks who signed the letter, you know, we're hoping that'll have some impact. Will it stop the war? I don't know. The president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute, Dr. Helen Caldicott, she's actually started an email campaign to the Vatican asking the Pope to travel to Baghdad. You know, and what she said on C-SPAN last Monday was the Pope is probably the only person on earth that George Bush wouldn't kill. Now, you know, while that may be strong, there may be some truth to it. Who knows? I do know that that campaign has gotten a tremendous, tremendous response.
And Charles Sheehan Miles, you're setting a broad table for us, and we thank you for bringing us up to date on your work. Thanks a lot for joining us from Virginia tonight.
Thank you.
James Carroll, the Pope to Baghdad, you're a one-time priest. Can you imagine it? And if you went, would it work?
Well,
the church has come out against the war.
Yes, the context, again, let's recall where we started. The context is the deadline is moving. A lot of unanticipated things can happen between now and March 17th, March 25th, mm-hmm. April 1st. Any number, and what we're having right this moment is a kind of gelling of world opposition to this war, then there are any number of things one could imagine. Certainly the Pope in Baghdad is one, although I think it's extremely unlikely. And who could say what the effect of such a thing would have? My own intuition is it would be a magnificent event. Whether it would slow down by itself the American war machine, I wouldn't take it for granted. But it wouldn't happen unless it was accompanied by other significant, powerful political events around the world. And it may not be George Bush's mind or Karl Rove's mind or Richard Pearl's mind that we're trying to change, but the poll numbers you cite, the broad awareness of the American population, that I believe that can change. It can change over the next week. It can change in 2 weeks. Americans are just now really paying attention to this problem. We've been listening to a kind of line from the United States government. And I think especially if Tony Blair and the British suddenly get some distance from this process.
That could get very spooky, couldn't
and,
it?
And a full collapse of the process at the United Nations, the United States in prospect in violation of the United Nations Charter. Let me just say, every day that the war doesn't begin is more hope that it doesn't have to. That's what I would say.
Ladies and gentlemen, there is the voice that says never surrender on the path to peace. We're talking about Hail Mary passes for peace tonight. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. What's your big idea to sidestep war? Jeff's calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
I have a harebrained notion.
Lay it on us.
Which came out of doing some creative thinking work. What if all of the countries that don't want the war to happen, like France, Germany, Russia, et cetera, were to sponsor millions of tourists to go to Iraq and communicate with Iraqi people, you know, try to sort of build a bridge?
Visit sunny Iraq. Is this like the Children's Crusade Redux, Jeff?
Well, I don't know. I don't know enough about that to compare it, but more like that anything can happen when people are in communication with each other, and that if, you know, millions of tourists were to go over there, it actually would help Iraq's economy. It would perhaps enable the Iraqi people to sort of build a circle around Saddam Hussein long enough to get rid of him or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it might actually be able to diffuse everything to the point where a war could be averted. And I actually just like to make one other quick observation.
Yes, Jeff.
Sorry?
Sure, yes, please.
Okay. Have you ever heard of do you remember the Uncle Remus stories?
Mm-hmm, sure. Brer Rabbit and all that?
Brer Rabbit, yeah. I keep thinking about the one about the tar baby, mm-hmm. where Brer Fox puts his tar baby out in the road, and Brer Rabbit, being the arrogant Brer Rabbit he was, can't help but get into a fight with his tar baby.
Give it a smack?
Yeah, both hands, feet and head stuck in this tar baby, and manages to get out because he convinces Brer Fox to throw him in the briar patch. But I can't help but think that Saddam Hussein is sort of like a tar baby. And the question is, who's Brer Fox?
yeah, and where's the briar patch once you get gummed up? But of course, that's not the plan. The plan is in and out with a high-powered military. But you've now got the image that what the U.S. forces might find on the beach is 2 million German tourists cavorting south of Basra somewhere.
Well, better yet, they would know that beforehand.
Yeah,
and you know, maybe they could even maybe somebody could sponsor a bonus for anybody who finds a missile or something.
Well, we're half joking with you, but we get the idea. And who hasn't thought? I mean, I heard this idea during the Bosnia conflict.
Something else that would. I'm sorry, say it again.
I heard this idea during the Bosnia conflict. It's appealing to think of people willing peace, just walking into the zone of war and making it impossible. We thank you for your harebrained, not so harebrained maybe idea, Jeff. We're taking all comers tonight. Tariq is calling. Welcome, Tariq. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope it's an opportunity to explore and listen to more ideas. Right now, I feel that our president is cornered, and he has to take action. We do have over 200,000 troops in the area, and there isn't a single soul, I think, that wants Saddam to continue. The effort is not only to disarm, but to actually disarm and bring him down, to have him removed. And so a lot of the countries that are not joining the United States right now are primarily not joining it because there must be a better way of bringing the man down and disarming him without having the casualties and the other price that we have to pay for such a war.
Tariq, you bear a famous name like Tariq Aziz. Are you Iraqi yourself?
No. I am of Egyptian origin, and I'm an American citizen right now.
Got it. You know how long Saddam Hussein has been there. What is the other way to bring him down? I mean, we hear that the special forces were asked if they couldn't just go in and drag him out of his palace, and they said, no, we don't know how to do it.
Well, there is what I'm thinking about is to actually combine both the purpose for the inspection teams and also the purpose for the military forces in the area. Right now, the inspection teams go into an area, they inspect it, and they leave, and they are exposed to books, etc. But once they leave, what is actually happening in that particular location?
Mm-hmm.
That's open. Nobody knows anything about. If it's left up to the inspection team to call in, say, 50 or 100 people from the forces waiting outside in a different area.
So you're saying begin to deputize those 200,000 troops as inspectors. Maybe this is the hard inspection line. Tariq, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, this hard inspection notion is one that we've heard before. Muscle up the inspections to the point that they are, there's a strong, very strong arm in them.
Yeah, and it gives sort of the frisson of war without some of without all of the horrible after effects. Michael Walzer, the political philosopher, outlined a program in the New York Times the other day, basically saying just something along these lines: extend the no-fly zone to cover the whole country, flood the country with inspectors, and have the inspectors accompanied by substantial numbers of UN troops to give credibility to their inspections, and as Tariq says, to look out over the sites, to keep watch on these sites after they leave them. And in short, to get real serious about measures short of war, but that have at the same time a very aggressive feel to them. But you know, the thing to make that possible, what could change things, I think, is suppose France suddenly understands that it's holding up possibly Saddam from coming clean. I mean, we have to face that fact, don't we? Suppose the French finally say, oh my gosh, you know what? The ambiguous signals we're giving here are encouraging war.
It's always a possibility. Jess Salicus, final word goes to you. Is it naive? We've heard a lot of ideas tonight. One can sense possibilities for an alternative. Is it naive to imagine?
No, it's not. And I think we have to work on both sides of the equation, both on the Iraqi side, the Saddam side, with some of the ideas that have been put forward today, as well as the American side, to try to figure out who will does George Bush listen to and how can we get to them.
Pressure on, but maybe room for peace. Jeswald Salicus, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jess Salicus is at the Fletcher School for Law and Diplomacy. James Carroll, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
James Carroll is columnist for the Boston Globe and author of Constantine's Sword. And Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by UR.